Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, the true crime boom has benefited HBO and Netflix and, oh yes, public radio. So we'll dive into its highs and lows and twists and turns. In our second segment, we're pausing to remember the very great Alan Rickman, who played everyone from a Hogwarts instructor to a king to Ronald Reagan to Hans Gruber, Die Hard's exceptional thief. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Microphone Check is NPR's hip-hop podcast. Hosts Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly talk to the biggest names and the best-kept secrets in hip-hop, from behind-the-scenes players to the next generation of rappers and producers, as well as artists like Pusha T and Masta Ace. Learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We're taking ourselves to court this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And in a very exciting development for me personally, in our fourth chair this week is my dear pal and former boss, Sarah D. Bunting. Sarah, what do you do?
I am the East Coast editor at Previously.tv and... more relevant to our discussion today, I'm the head rodeo clown at true crime review site, The Blotter. That's the-blotter.com. To be clear, we do not review the crimes themselves.
Right.
Talented freelancers and I do not sit around assigning letter grades to bank robberies and
the like. Right. And Sarah also appears on the terrific podcast Extra Hot Great.
Uh-huh.
And again with this, which is their 90210 show, which, as you know, if you listen to this show, I'm obsessed with. But that's okay. It's cool. Sarah was also my boss at Television Without Pity, so we go back a long way. And the entire time that I've known you, Sarah, you have been a true crime person, as I am myself.
Indeed.
Which is one of the reasons why we thought it would be so much fun to have you here for this conversation. Now, the first thing that I want to ask you is, how do you even define what you consider true crime?
It really is a huge genre, because you have literary nonfiction like Capote's In Cold Blood. You have TV series like The Staircase, like Making a Murderer, like The Jinx. You have many, many documentaries like the Paradise Lost series, which were films, but really were TV.
Right.
I count the Lifetime movies if they're about actual crimes.
Sure, after a fashion.
Hayden Panettiere is Foxy Noxy, What's Not to Love.
Yeah.
And then you have that whole sad... they don't bother to change the light bulbs above the bookshelf section of Barnes & Noble, where all the books have black covers with shiny red writing on it, and that's also true crime.
So. Well, and also I would say the entire basic cable Discovery ID Dateline /
2020 /
Death by Gossip with Wendy Williams.
Yes. Wives with
for
knives.
Examples.
Yeah, for example. And of course, what got us talking about this in recent weeks is the Netflix series Making a Murderer, which came out right before Christmas, and talks about the story of Stephen Avery, who's a guy who lived in Wisconsin and was first convicted of rape and spent almost 20 years in prison for that and was then exonerated with DNA testing. And then very shortly after his release was arrested and eventually convicted of raping and murdering a woman, a case that ultimately also involved his nephew, who's very young. And it is a very complex case that went on for a very long time and involved a lot of people and involves a lot of law enforcement who are kind of, I think, by the documentarians, accused, perhaps indirectly, of various things they shouldn't have done. Sarah, what did you think about Making a Murderer?
First of all, the drop date for a TV critic such as myself was rage-making, frankly, that they plunked it down like the week before Christmas.
Yeah.
I said, guys, and that says to me that it's not good and they're trying to dump it. That was wrong thinking on my part because I found it extremely compelling. I thought it was exceptionally well-made. Serial was, I think, really the beginning of this trend in our culture of taking true crime seriously and expecting better of it and not thinking it's all uniformly trashy.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see how post Making a Murderer, that the original reaction to it was sort of rapturous, I would say, in terms of its quality, and horrified in terms of some of the, I would say, allegations that the documentarians are pretty clearly making. But after that, there's now been kind of this other pushback that there's a lot that was left out. There's a piece in The New Yorker by Catherine Schultz that gets at some of that stuff. So it's been interesting to see kind of the cyclical nature of it.
Well, I'm interested to hear what you guys think about what the documentary itself and what the backlash against it are trying to tell us or get us to think about in terms of what we mean by a documentary.
Right. And what a series like that is supposed to do. Did you watch it, Glenn?
I did. I have to back up a little bit. There's going to be quite a ramp up here, so settle in.
But, you don't say.
Yeah.
I packed a lunch.
All right. So how we consume culture is different now, right? In a world after television, that pity, I'm just going to say we have almost an adversarial relationship to what we watch, a friendly adversarial relationship to it. It's a sort of a skeptical eye. It's an ironic eye. It's often a withering eye. And that is fine for things like scripted television because it's made to engender some of that response for you.
Yeah.
It's fine for me for reality television because those people who go on The Bachelor are not human beings.
Right.
So it's okay to make fun of them. True crime, on one level or another, is about real people suffering. I'm not saying this because I'm a good person, because I'm not, but I find that I love my true crime coated with a thick layer of cheesiness.
Yeah.
And the closer it gets to the bone, the more that reflexive response of just clashes. So many times on this, watching this show, I went into it with a, wow, look at that owl lamp. That must be...
God someone else was trying to source the owl lamp.
It's like an owl's
I did find it on Etsy.
Yes, yes.
Talk to me after the show.
Absolutely. The times when the kid who's implicated in this thing, the conversations between him and his mom, some of them, especially the one that ends with toes, just hugely funny. And you're like, well, this kid isn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, huh? And then he'll say something to his mom like, but I'm stupid, mom.
Well,
I'm stupid.
That's
the thing.
Then
it's like, oof.
It's terrible. There's not... there's nothing, I agree with you. There's no way to watch it with that sense of detachment intact.
No. And so I'm having to wrestle with it.
Yeah. You are always, as a person making a documentary or a documentary series or whatever, you are always making choices about what you are going to put in and what you're going to leave out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's only fair to say, like, I think based on this documentary, you walk away feeling like nothing in this, a lot of stuff in this didn't make sense. But you're really evaluating the trial as it is in the documentary, not necessarily the trial as it was in real life. And preserving the trust of the viewer that that relationship is a close one is part of what I think it has to do.
Yeah. You're seeing that conversation come up, which is going to come up again when the next Michael Moore movie comes out.
Yeah.
Is when we say documentary, is what we want a document, or do we want a strict recording of events with no so-called agenda? My feeling is you have to impose an agenda, or it's just like surveillance footage and court transcripts, and you have to impose the narrative on it so that it's consumable.
Right.
But there's also the axis of someone died. And this is where it gets tricky with true crime as well, that there is that voyeuristic aspect. You do have to feel and understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost naive to expect that a documentarian or a filmmaker is not going to impose some sort of agenda. I mean, you can't accumulate all this footage or even make the decision to tell this story without a certain amount of trying to get to the bottom of something and ordering it just in your own head or as you're editing the footage. I mean, Glenn used a really useful phrase when talking about Making a Murderer, which is hitting close to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if all these voices and all these accents and all these faces and all the officials are where you grew up.
Yeah.
And in that first episode where they're talking to the Avery family, particularly about this first case, the case from which he was ultimately exonerated, it was astounding to me how much those voices sounded like specific people I grew up with, right down to the police, not like in the community, not liking this one family.
Mm-hmm.
And the rush to judge this family based on the behavior of the family. I could just take, like, almost shuffle the letters in the name to come up with the family in my hometown that people said that about.
Yeah.
And so I found it very, very compelling and very strikingly made, very well made. But for me, it hit very, very, very close to my literal home.
And right. I think that takes us kind of into, as you pull back from this individual project to talk about true crime more generally, I think one of the things that always appeals to people about it is a place where you get very specific stories about extraordinary circumstances. And I know, Sarah, you've read a lot of Anne Rule, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I've read
a lot. May she rest.
Exactly. May she rest. I've read a lot of Anne Rule. She wrote The Stranger Beside Me about Ted Bundy, and she wrote Small Sacrifices about Diane Downs, which is the one that I was thinking about in making this point, which is that is just a crazy story. You do have that voyeuristic aspect, but part of it is just people are interesting and weird. Yeah. And it's if you're a good writer, a crime is a situation that involves necessarily extraordinary circumstances. Mm-hmm. So you wind up writing about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, in Making a Murderer, you don't see the documentarians struggling to piece this together. They're not foregrounded. Similarly, Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line, mm-hmm. he goes out of his way so that these people are talking to you. It's all about implicating you in this procedure in some way. Unlike Serial, where she is foregrounded. As she tries to piece these things together, the story is her figuring things out for herself.
Right.
In addition to the layer of the actual crime.
In a lot of ways, Serial is a journalism procedural.
Yeah.
You know, and I think one of the things that you have to always consider with true crime, and Stephen talked about a little bit, you have to impose a little bit of a narrative, and I guess Sarah talked about this too, that you have to impose a little bit of a narrative or it's not coherent, is that part of the question becomes, are you doing journalism or are you doing nonfiction entertainment, which is not necessarily the same thing? Mm-hmm.
Every genre of everything is 80% crap.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep.
True crime is the same. But I happen to be reading a 30-year-old, like, pretty workmanlike paperback about a series of bombings in Salt Lake 30 years ago involving forged documents, and some of it's really good. And whether it's good or bad, I think there's a basic human instinct, particularly with something like Serial, like Making a Murderer, where you really can't be sure.
Right.
Like, there's never going to be that moment mm-hmm. where someone is given truth serum or that document is uncovered. You think it's going to be there. Of course, the author or broadcaster or documentarians want it to be there. But there is a very natural human instinct, which is why we're all still obsessed with Jack the Ripper and the Lindbergh case, mm-hmm. to get the answer.
Right.
But that, I wouldn't call it pleasant is not the right word. Compelling, alluring, when it's unsolved.
Well, think about how much storytelling is predictable, right? I mean, think about how many mysteries get spoiled for you before you get a chance to watch them. There really is something terribly compelling about this sense that you are right there with the principals in this story trying to solve it. And I mean, one of the interesting things about Making a Murderer, I just read an article the other day where the documentarians were talking about people were coming back to them having gleaned clues from watching this 10-hour documentary and saying, like, if you look in this photo, she's got this ring of keys, but here they only found one key.
Yeah.
And, like, you have the people at home who are kind of crowdsourcing a possible solution to this mystery. That is a terribly exciting thing to be a part of if that's something that you enjoy.
But it's, I think as somebody who's working on a piece of true crime, whether it's television or book or whatever, I do think you have to keep in mind that one of the risks is if you do wind up, you know, I think Making a Murderer is a good example, but I think there are other examples where if you do it and you appear to be an advocate and then there appear to be flaws in your process, you can do kind of more harm than good.
Sure.
And I think it remains to be seen how this series is ultimately going to affect the way people see this case. Because one of the things about this series is there are two totally different things that they are theoretically making this series about. One is process, and the other is ultimately, are you guilty?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think in a movie like Paradise Lost, it was a little easier on the filmmakers because they were both presenting the thesis, this is screwed up, what happened? And they were presenting the thesis, these people are fundamentally not only not guilty, but really quite harmless, right?
Yeah.
Whereas I think in Making a Murderer, there's a grayer area in terms of you're arguing the process. You're not as much arguing the point of whether the people are guilty or not, which as a matter of technique, of like documentary technique, there's no reason you can't do that, but it's tricky. It's complicated. And I think it complicates your storytelling a little bit.
Well, the reaction that it's getting is complicated. You can feel the culture trying to put this in the same box that it would put Dateline To Catch a Predator. You can feel that. But as Sarah pointed out, yes, there is millions of examples of this. This happens to be a very rigorous one. And so when you see people creating Twitter accounts about sexy lawyers and like, oh, they're so hot.
That's a little weird.
Is just, ugh, it just feels one step beyond.
I get it, but it's a little weird.
Yeah.
You know, but Sarah is right, too, in that there's always been literary, highbrow true crime, mm-hmm. right? Or higher brow true crime. She mentioned Truman Capote, but also Helter Skelter is more literary, Fatal Vision, mm-hmm. stuff like that. The ones that are a little more...
Executioner Song?
Executioner Song, absolutely. And The Thin Blue Line. Mm-hmm. What are your favorites, Sarah?
The Staircase from 2002, I believe, was the not just the gold standard. It was like the best and the worst of the literary television true crime documentary because it was the only thing of its type.
Yeah.
Kind of, until Making a Murderer came along, which I hope this is the dawn of more projects like this that are finding their own way narratively and not feeling like they're confined by whatever medium they end up in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fatal Vision is fantastic. The miniseries is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
The Deliberate Stranger was not a great book, but that miniseries also holds up. We think of Mark Harmon as, you know, harmless.
Jethro.
Avenging crimes navally.
Yeah.
But he really was this perfect Ted Bundy.
He was creepy in that. He was very creepy in that.
And he was People Magazine's sexiest man alive at the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For a long time, they were making these miniseries, like these ABC. I want to say mostly ABC, but I could be wrong.
Farrah Fawcett was Diane Downs.
She sure was.
She was great. These things were regularly on during May sweeps.
Yeah.
When I was a kid.
The TV, I don't remember if it was a movie or I think it's a miniseries, of Small Sacrifices is very well done. And Farrah Fawcett is very good and very scary in it, I think.
The last 10 minutes of the last episode of The Jinx, whatever your feelings are about what they should have or shouldn't have done and how they constructed those last 10 minutes and how they led us to those last 10 minutes, that was the last time my jaw was on the floor. I mean, the intensity of that and the feeling that you are part of something that is a huge revelation, which is the exact opposite of what Sarah was talking about before, about how this ambiguity,
right?
There is a finality to that that is just crushing.
But here's the thing. I actually, in terms of narrative, kind of how compelling it was narratively, I found that less interesting than the misspelling thing.
Yeah, well, that's
which was the one, which was the one, like the thing everybody talked about was the other thing, was mm-hmm. the muttering live mic
right.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, the misspelling thing, was the one where I went, holy cow. Yep. Like that was the thing that I actually found more compelling, if not maybe quite as cinematic.
Do we break these things into categories based on whether they have reenactments? Because
it was very controversial when Errol Morris did it in The Thin Blue Line.
I am so instantly skeptical when there are reenactments. And I'm sure there are a million exceptions to this. But when we talk about which ones make you more skeptical, I am immediately made skeptical by reenactments. That's where I go to that like late night basic cable grainy footage of an actor who has a beard,
and
therefore looks like the guy, kind of.
Yep.
That's where I, even in a highbrow work,
right,
reenactments or casting major actors to play these things, it immediately feels fictionalized in the way that a more documentary style approach doesn't, even though, of course, there are biases inherent to that as well.
Yep.
Well, and we're about to see in a big way with American Crime Story.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Casting is just going to snakes on a plane the thing from the film. I have a feeling
Have you watched those, Sarah?
I haven't done it yet
this
weekend.
So I've seen the first six. This is the FX. This is the upcoming FX American Crime Story, The People versus O.J. Simpson. Mm-hmm. There's nothing funny about this crime, but I will tell you, Cuba Gooding Jr. as O.J. Simpson and Malcolm Jamal Warner as A.C. Cowlings driving down the highway in the white Bronco gives you this very weird moment, like Sarah says, of like, what am I watching? Not to mention John Travolta as Robert Shapiro.
Right.
And not to mention...
And Ross.
Okay.
So Dashian?
Yes. What? David Schwimmer as Robert Kardashian. And the thing that's really funny about it is the casting really takes some time to get used to for exactly this reason. It keeps feeling like, oh, sure, okay. Like
also starring.
That's how I felt about the whole thing, is I kept watching it, sort of going, Okay, sure.
I don't know. They lost me at the very beginning of this conversation.
In the six that I have seen, the first three really struggle with filmed Wikipedia page syndrome, as I have sometimes talked about it, where you feel like you've seen all this, you know all this, you're seeing the pegboard of major moments just kind of passed along, including a lot of these little girls are the Kardashians. Get it, get it, get it, which I find irritating. But in the next three, they become much more interesting. The Courtney B. Vance take on Johnny Cochran actually becomes sort of fascinating. And that and Sarah Paulson playing Marcia Clark become the centers of the story. And you start to get a little more nuanced perspective. But I think that's one of the challenges in a story that everybody knows is like, maybe it's my, maybe you have to be of the correct age and maybe our younger listeners are like, I don't know very much about
this. Yeah, maybe that is the question of, you know, who is this for? Is this for the Scream Queens Ryan Murphy fans who weren't born when this happened?
Because Ryan Murphy is, I don't think I mentioned, but is an EP of this and did a lot of work on it. And it's another one of his anthology series because apparently they're going to do a new American Crime every year. Well, I know that a lot of you watched Making a Murderer because a lot of you asked us to talk about it. I don't know how many of you are into other true crime, but I will be very curious to hear what you think about true crime, what you think about Making a Murderer. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Alan Rickman, who died last week. We have many wonderful memories of him in many wonderful, wonderful films. So come right back and we'll talk about that.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from TaxAct, the easy, fast, and affordable way to file federal and state tax returns. And TaxAct will guide you every step of the way. Start anywhere and finish anytime on your computer, tablet, or phone. If your deal is getting the best deal, go to taxact.com/pop and get simple federal and state returns free. TaxAct.com. You got this.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We are taking a bit of a swerve because we learned last week that Alan Rickman, who was 69 years old, far too young, in my opinion, had died. You may know him from theater, respectable things such as theater, Harry Potter, a children's movie series with which you might be familiar, Die Hard, one of my favorite movies of all time, with which you may be familiar.
Galaxy Quest, one of my favorite movies of all time.
Galaxy Quest. You know, a guy who was both a highbrow and a broadly popular entertainer. And Glenn, why don't you kick us off?
Well, I'm going to start with a very, very brief clip from a film that is not Die Hard, not his movie screen debut, but that came out the very next year.
Languish there, darling. Don't molest anything.
Boy, right there. That is Alan Rickman in, like, white dwarf concentrated Alan Rickman. The Alan Rickmanosity of that.
Yeah.
Don't molest anything. Just that.
I could draw that pronunciation.
Absolutely.
Gorgeous.
It's so fantastic. And, you know.
What is that?
That is from a terrible 1989 film called The January Man, starring Kevin Kline and Rod Steiger chewing the scenery. It's just awful. He started there, thing that he would continue throughout his career, being the best thing in bad things, being the best thing in movies that underperform. The January Man is terrible. Dogma, Kevin Smith's Dogma, doesn't really hang together, but his Metatron is the best thing in it. The film version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, not good, all over the map. His voicing of Marvin the Robot is just perfect. So that's who he is. Ronald Reagan in Lee Daniels' The Butler. Whatever you think of that film, boy, that's Alan Rickman playing Ronald Reagan there.
You can tell I haven't seen that because
And they say there's nothing left to learn.
How about you, Sarah?
Mine is pretty straight down the fairway. Jessica, can we hear a clip from Die Hard, please?
Good. Then you'll give us what we want and save your friend's life. You're not part of this equation. It's time you realized that.
Hey, what am I, method actor Hans? They put away the gun. This is radio, not television.
That might have been a little on the nose for the group. In fact, it might have been the nose. Rickman as Hans Gruber, this is what I call a Poppy Fields movie. You wander into it on cable, and you're completely becalmed in front of it until the end. I think a big part of it is Alan Rickman, who I think, with the possible exception of Zod, Terrence Stamp Zod, is the best realized film villain of all time.
Yep.
The most subtle, the most nuanced, without having a dippy, tiresome backstory or going all Buggy Hambone. It's him. It's his suit. It's John McClane. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's right.
It really is. And I wrote about Die Hard at one point and admitted that for many years, there is a moment in which Hans commits a very grisly murder close to the beginning of the movie that I always thought, why is this in here? This feels a little too kind of brutal and gross. And it's one of the few moments that I just find very, very hard to watch and very sad. I thought, yeah, no, I don't know if they really, like, why does that need to be in there? And then I thought, it has to be in there or you'd root for him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It has to be in there or you're, or the whole time you'd be thinking, maybe somehow he can turn out to be a good guy and somehow he and John McClane can become partners and go and do heists together, you know, team up and do like Ocean's 14. I mean, because
I know he fell off the building and exploded, but I still believe. Yeah. There's the animated version.
It's true. And if you, but if you didn't have that, he's so charming and he's so smart. I mean, I think that's, it's very rare for villains in movies. They are sometimes very smart. It's unusual for them to be so smart and also so rational and disciplined, not to be kind of ranting wildly. And one of the things I love about this is there's a moment where he appears to be going down a very classic movie villain thing of saying, you know, I'm holding all these people hostage because I want the release of XXX people, prisoners, whatever. And then he turns to his guy and turns away from the walkie-talkie and says, I read about them in Time magazine. And he's just a thief. That's what, that's the great thing about the movie. He's utterly rational. His plan is actually really good. It's a really good plan.
He's a good manager.
He's a good manager. Yeah. It is such a good performance. It is such a big part of what makes that movie so great.
And that's his first film role, right?
Yeah.
We will be boiled by people if we don't mention he was already an incredibly accomplished theater actor.
Sure.
There are people who, when he died, talked about seeing him in Dangerous Liaisons and
Sense and Sensibility.
And the film of Sense and Sensibility. He's an incredibly accomplished actor. I don't want to suggest he's just Harry Potter and Die Hard, but
well,
yeah, he was good in this.
I brought a lesser known example of a movie that knocks me dead every time I see it. And I have already reached my quotient for crying on this podcast in 2016. I'm not your Johnny Ray. don't just bring me out here to weep for
Jack Parr.
for those we've lost.
Yeah, but the film role for him that really balances out his very very diverse film output is a 1990 film called Truly Madly Deeply. This movie is not for everybody.
He is the best thing in that movie.
He is definitely.
There is a scene in this movie where they meet the main character, his ex-wife, and this new guy meet, and they introduce each other as they're hopping, and it made me want to burn the screen down. But he is the best thing in that
film. It is a very romantic film about grief. Mm. Alan Rickman's character in this movie has recently died. His wife is dealing with the loss. It was very sudden and unexpected. This movie came out the same year as Ghost, which took this plot in a very different direction, involving actual heaven and actual hell. This movie is, I know there are people who find it mawkish. There are scenes in it, especially when taken out of context, that don't work as well. As a whole, it is a beautiful story about grief. And what I love about what Alan Rickman does in this movie, and part of this, I'm sure, is the writer-director Anthony Minghella, who went on to make The English Patient and The Talented Mr. Ripley, made the decision to make his character, who comes back as a ghost in her apartment, to make him kind of a grump, to make him kind of a fusspot, to make him the same grumpy fusspot that he was in his life. And he's a little sour, and he's complaining about the door isn't locked. And at one point, he's complaining about politicians. And she's like, why do you still care about politicians? I love that movie. And if you want to watch a movie about missing Alan Rickman, this is a movie about missing Alan Rickman.
And as disciplined and nuanced as his performance in Die Hard is, his performance in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves is the antithesis of this, because he's an actor, right? He can go big.
He can do both.
Or go small, and he goes so big. And it's, what do you remember about Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves? The shot of the arrow going into the tree, which wasn't originally in the film, and Alan Rickman being Alan Rickman, Alan Rickmaning around to beat the baddie. Awesome. Similarly, his Snape in the Harry Potter films could be read as like a turning up the dial, maybe self-parody of the Alan Rickman letting vowels and consonants curve around each other.
Yes.
And then come slap you in the back. Like, yeah. So good.
Oh, no, man. That's true. And I think He was also, I think, the part of the emotional center of Love Actually, which is another movie that some people like and some people don't like. I would say it is wildly uneven. But the storyline that he has with Emma Thompson in that movie is, I think, its most emotionally mature part by far. And one of the things that he does that's so generous as an actor in that movie, I think, is to really just be Weak, who is hurting his wife, not out of malice, but out of being a weak guy in some ways. Being willing to play that in that way is from a place of strength as an actor. And I would also point out, he made a film called A Little Chaos that I believe came out last year. Around that film, did an interview with a friend of the show, Jesse Thorne, on Bullseye, which is a wonderful interview that you should seek out for sure. It's a very charming interview. It is my favorite interview with Rickman that I've ever heard.
Yeah.
We are in Galaxy Quest, which I don't think we have mentioned.
We've mentioned it, but what is there to say about it? It's perfect. He's perfect. That is a actor meant for that role. They just go together so well. He is the most Alan Rickman anybody could be in that role.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, watch Die Hard, watch some Harry Potter movies, watch Galaxy Quest, watch Truly, Madly, Deeply if you can track it down, watch Sense and Sensibility.
Yeah.
It's all good stuff. Good stuff. All right. When we come back, we are going to move on to our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So don't go away.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Microphone Check is NPR's hip-hop podcast. Hosts Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly talk to the biggest names and the best-kept secrets in hip-hop, from behind-the-scenes players to the next generation of rappers and producers, as well as artists like Pusha T and Masta Ace. Learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, as I've mentioned on this show before, about 7 months ago, girlfriend moved in. She's a big book reader. I would have no ability to get her into a book were it not for our little podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour. Over the weekend, she blew through all of the accumulated Ms. Marvel that I have saved because we talked about it on the show, because I loved it so much, trying to get my daughter into it as well. She picked it up over the weekend and just blew through it and I overheard her describing it as perfect. If you have not, I mean, I know we did an entire segment about this book on the show before, but seeing others around me fall in love with it as much as I have fallen in love with it, I'm still reading it. I'm continuing to buy anthologies of that
Excellent.
Book.
Nice.
Ms. Marvel, oh my God, it's wonderful. If you have kids, just buy it, read it. It's great. It doesn't matter if you have kids. The other thing is, as much as it filled me with rage and horror to see my colleagues, Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton, succeed, the All Songs Considered podcast celebrated its Sweet 16 at Washington, D.C.'s 930 Club last week, and it was an absolute, Linda, you were there.
I was.
Just an absolute unmitigated, wonderful success, seeing people who listen to that show, who know Bob and Robin, seeing them come to not only celebrate a really wonderful NPR podcast that has been very, very good to me, but to just marinate in the wonderful music that they put together, some of which we have already started trickling out in video form on the NPR music page. You can already see Glenn Hanser, about whom Linda has feelings. You can see a little bit of Glenn Hansard's set. Laura Gibson, who inspired the Tiny Desk concert series, performed. Kishibashi is another Linda Holmes favorite. Dan Deacon did one of his dance parties. He was just mentioned on this show. Sharon Van Etten, who's a big favorite of ours. Ours being me, Bob, and Robin.
And Suffers.
And The Suffers, who Margaret Willison recommended on this show on an episode that I was not on. If I had been on the show, I would have said, Margaret Willison, you are right about The Suffers. They are great. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, they were so good. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but it was really a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
A couple things. First off, I need to second something you said last week, and third, and fourth, and fifth it. Angie, Tribeca.
Yes.
Holy crap. Holy, it is so good and so stupid.
Yes.
One thing tied inextricably up with
the
other.
That is almost the exact Tara Ariano review for those of you who are Tara people.
It is
accurate.
So, so good. And, you know, I have seen some grousing online that it's like latter day Leslie Nielsen stuff, which don't. How dare you, sir? That is an insult. I am one of these people who feels that The Naked Gun was far inferior to Police Squad, and I think
of course you do.
This is staking out Police Squad era. I think it's
if you like The Naked Gun, but wish the jokes came more slowly.
Yes, it's so good. It's superior. They were trying too hard in Naked Gun. The Police Squad, they had that tension, that rigor, right in. And they were in this sweet spot. They lasted for 6 episodes, and then lesser. Yeah, sure, but still good. Anyway, what channel is it on? I don't know.
TBS.
TBS. Angie Tribeca. The other thing is on the website The Kernel, KERNEL, there is an oral history of, wait, I know. I'm over them too.
Uh-huh.
Hear me out. Mm-hmm. An oral history of a special thing, the world's most important comedy message board. A special thing was created by Matt Belknap, who is now the producer of Never Not Funny, the Jimmy Pardo podcast, which is very, very good. He would go to shows and review comics in the aughts, pretty much. And this thing nurtured and kept the alt comedy scene, especially in and around LA, kind of fomenting at a time after a crash. And it kind of helped bring about this boom, I think. It helped really kind of connect comedians with their audience, and then that kind of went south. This oral history kind of lays that all out, and you can see the seeds of the current comedy podcast boom right there. And those connections are one. It's really a fascinating thing. There was this gap in my knowledge of, you know, how one boom led to a bust, led to another boom, and that kind of fills it out very nicely. So that's on the website, The Kernel. It's called An Oral History of a Special Thing, the World's Most Important Comedy Message Board.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Sarah Bunting, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
A bunch of things, actually, which is sort of unprecedented. Usually I have to cast about.
Uh-huh.
But I'm going to go with the book that I was reading on the train. Nearly missed my stop on my way in to talk to you fine people. It is called Cardboard Gods by a man named Josh Wilker, W-I-L-K-E-R. It is a memoir that he tells of his childhood and adolescence via his baseball cards that he collected. Those are the chapter headings. His prose is very direct and beautiful. It's like he grew up in the 70s and 80s. So when I say that the prose is like a lens flare, I mean that in the best possible way. And I think my favorite part is when he talks about the card that he kept getting duplicates of, which if any of you collected sports cards, there was always that one guy. You got him in every pack. Mine was Dave Steeb. I had more pictures of Dave Steeb, who was a pitcher for the Blue Jays, was actually pretty good. I had more pictures of this kid than Mrs. Dave Steeb. And when you bring this up to people who collected sports cards, I asked my dad about it one time, and I hadn't even finished the sentence when he groused, Reno Bertoia. Still mad about it. I think he wallpapered half of his and my uncle's room with Bertoiae. Anyway, Josh Wilker's Cardboard Gods. It's from 2010. It's just really wonderful. I'm sort of getting to the end of it, and I love that feeling in a book when you're concerned. You realize you're running out of book, and you love that feeling, but also it's sad because you're going to run out of book.
Yeah,
so I may
just
flip it over and start at the beginning.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing to like about that. All right. Thank you very much, Sarah Bunting. I am a little short of new things to be happy about this week because they have all been things that other people have or would already talk about. One of them was getting to go to the All Songs Considered Sweet 16, which Stephen already talked about, which was wonderful for me. And I saw a bunch of pals and got to see Glenn Hansard. And with whom I have a long history of making exactly that noise. Every time he says tanks.
The Frau Blücher noise.
It is the Frau Blücher noise.
It is, but it's a different version of it. It's the Irish busker version.
Sure.
Thanks to them for that. Also, he's not going to tell you, but I got a copy of Glenn's Galley for his upcoming book, The Caped Crusade, which
so
is
excited.
All about Batman. I'm very excited to read that. And then also, Stephen talked a couple of weeks ago, a few weeks back, about the movie Brooklyn, which is such a lovely film, nominated for Best Picture and Best Actress and a couple other things. It is a really charming touching film that does a very good job of making the argument that I often try to make, which is there are lots of things for drama to be about. They don't always have to be about destruction and dystopia. There are other ways to create stakes in film or on television. And when I argue that drama on television in particular is overly concerned with people shooting each other or doing other horrible, horrible things to each other, it is less because I am offended by it and more because they ignore all of the other things that dramas can be about. And Brooklyn is about the other things that dramas can be about, because all of the stakes in this movie are people's feelings. It's lovely. It's romantic. It is costumed in such a beautiful and interesting and thoughtful way that even I, as a person who does not know that much about costumes, was able to notice particular things and say, I see what they are doing with this coat and this coat in this room, and as opposed to the one she's wearing in this other scene. They repeat clothing in this movie because she is a person who would not naturally have endless outfits. And so you see the same clothing over and over, which is very rare in film, especially a movie that they want to be beautiful and sumptuous. They will just show you outfit after outfit after outfit. And it's such a pretty movie that that's kind of what you would expect, but they don't, because it wouldn't be honest. And I think that's really why it's done that way. And it's a fantastic movie. I cannot say enough about how much I like it. I know Stephen already talked about
beat me to the punch,
as it were. So that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Sarah at Tomato Nation. And you can also find her writing at previously.tv. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah. And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.